plenty of people change over time as they mature, gain a life experience, getting softer or tougher or wiser. With Vladimir Putin, it would seem those changes are something different, at least when it comes to his relationship to U.S. leaders. Putin hasn't exactly evolved over time. It's more like he has carefully crafted five different personas for each of the five American presidents he's dealt with. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Putin came across, at least initially, as sincere to George W. Bush. He was insufferably arrogant with Obama and appeared to fawn over Donald Trump, who was charmed. So how have U.S. leaders' dealings with Putin played into Russian actions in Georgia, Crimea, and now all of Ukraine? Journalist Michael Kirk is a filmmaker with the PBS documentary series Frontline. His latest production is titled Putin and the Presidents. Michael, welcome back to Think.
It's so great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. But Putin sent Russian troops to invade Ukraine in part on these false claims that he's trying to rescue people there from a growing neo-Nazi movement. He's believed for a long time that Ukraine never deserved independence. The film, though, notes right off the top that he seems to see his real enemy in this conflict as Western democracies and specifically NATO member states. How were the seeds of Putin's understanding of the threats to Russia planted in the Cold War?
I think you've assessed it absolutely accurately. I think he, what dawned on us as we were looking back at over the five presidents and how they dealt with him and how he dealt with them, what dawned on us was that he's really been at war with America and, as you say, the West for 25 years since he was himself made the president of Russia, even though a lot of people, especially American presidents, didn't really know that, think that, misjudged him, misplayed him, mishandled him, mis-everything to him from the very, very beginning. So I think every one of them, either by benign neglect or in other ways, just fed a kind of growing grievance in Putin for revenge for what happened to the USSR, and out of just not wanting to think he was worth the trouble, he has taken that as a signal that no American president was ever going to try to stop him. He could act like a schoolyard bully and get away with it, and we would never, we in the West would never get our act together to do anything about it. And in a way, that was for him the green light to go after Ukraine.
Of course, as a KGB officer early in his career, he was trained to essentially fight the United States. So the collapse of the Soviet Union to him felt like a devastating personal humiliation.
Yes, he has said that he thought it, this is not a direct quote, but more or less right, that he thought the breakup of the USSR was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the last century. To him, young man in Dresden, watching Ronald Reagan say, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," referencing the Berlin Wall, was the starting pistol of just American hegemony under the guise of democracy coming in and destroying the wonderful, tremendously highly developed society of Russia and the USSR in favor of our commercial interests in the world. He just literally could not comprehend that that such a thing would happen. And when it did, he kept the secret for a number of years. He secretly began to enact a plan, a personal plan, to take over and reunite the Russian Empire.
Right. So he's not just dreaming of leading Russia back to what he considers greatness. He wants the Soviet Union back in place.
He wants it all. Yeah. And he has said about Ukraine, for example, what to me was the most telling thing, Chris. He said Russia without Ukraine is just a country. Russia with Ukraine is an empire. And I think he believes that. He's a man of action. And now he's trying to take the first step of recreating the Russian Empire.
How did he begin to move into politics?
He was, as you said, a KGB agent, and for people who are not of a certain age, let's say over 50, the KGB was the CIA for the Soviet Union, was really tough, horrible, helped the rulers of Russia impose unbelievable lifestyles and punishments on the people of the USSR. They were very, very tough foes about America everywhere in the world where they could be. During the Cold War, it really was a Cold War. We weren't shooting with them all the time or anything, but boy, oh boy, oh boy, were we one-on-one. So he is of that generation, that worldview, that everything. It's a duplicitous worldview. He was a counterterrorism agent. So he was, very suspicious, very paranoid by his psychology was personally very paranoid and suspicious of anything that America did and the West did. So he starts low in St. Petersburg as an apparatchik, sort of just a worker in the bureaucracy, and slowly but surely works his way up to being number two to Boris Yeltsin, the president of Russia, who was picked by the Americans to lead the country as a sort of new outpost of democracy and really a new marketplace for America. So, and we had no idea, and neither did most Russians, what he was really like or who he was really going to be if he ever got the top job. And of course, when he did get the top job, he began to enact his master plan.
So, Michael, the first U.S. president Putin met personally was Bill Clinton. This took place at the Kremlin, which was Putin's home territory. But Putin didn't even pretend to be a gracious host, even down to his body language.
He's a bully in every sense of the word, they tell us. He slouches. He sits with his very best mansplaining, legs spreading, kind of obnoxious stance that many men, and especially Putin, bring to the table when they're negotiating, his arms kind of dismissively flailing around. Bill Clinton, now at the end of his presidency and visiting Putin before he leaves office to meet the new president of what was one of Clinton's foreign policy agenda items. Here's Clinton sitting here and not used to not being kowtowed to. And when Putin just basically didn't give him what he wanted in terms of thanks and appreciation and obeisance and whatever else it is, Clinton took real offense and was himself deeply suspicious of who Putin really was.
Putin is not a large man physically, and I don't want to get too much into psychology here, but do you think that has also been a factor in his one-on-one meetings with U.S. presidents, who by and large tend to be a little bit taller than average?
Yeah, he's in every way suffering from the Napoleonic size and shape complex. Yeah, I think there's no doubt about it. His upbringing was in a really tough project back during the darkest, coldest years of the Cold War of the USSR, living in as he did in St. Petersburg, then called, now it's escaping me, then called whatever it was,
Leningrad, right, or Stalingrad.
Leningrad.
Yeah.
Thank you. He lived in a project, and he would, the stories about him, some of them a little hagiographic, I suppose, but he is famous for, he would get up every morning and he would say, who am I going to fight today down in the courtyard? How am I going to make my bones today? And he would go down and pick fights with the biggest guys down there. It was his stock and trade, always feisty, always rumbling, ready to prove himself one way or another. And I think that's also, to be an easy armchair psychologist, that's a lot of the traits of shorter in stature that people, especially men who find themselves having to defend themselves because of their size and lack of apparent strength. He won as many of those fights as he lost, but he was always ready to rumble.
Clinton had connected somewhat better with Putin's predecessor, former President Boris Yeltsin, actually told Yeltsin on this trip to Moscow where he met Putin for the first time that he didn't really trust Putin. I'm assuming this got right back to Putin.
Well, probably it's a remarkable revelation, actually. Here's the president of the United States told to us by his top aide, Strobe Talbot, who was with him in both instances, both at the Kremlin when Putin sort of disses him, and then when Clinton drives over, jumps in his car and says, "Take me to Yeltsin," drives over to Yeltsin's dacha, goes in and gives him a big bear hug. We see that happen. And then he sits with Yeltsin and he reaches across and he pokes at his chest, Clinton does, and he says, "This man, I'm very worried about him, Boris, the new young man. He doesn't seem to have democracy in his heart." And it quite shocks Yeltsin, who was very worried after that point. And they say that when Talbot told us that when Yeltsin was dying, he admitted to friends who were surrounding him that Clinton had been right and that he had misjudged and miscalculated what Boris Yeltsin was really like, and that Clinton had been right. There was no democracy in his heart.
Well, Yeltsin was in good company. The next U.S. leader to sit down with Putin one-on-one was George W. Bush. And initially, that relationship seemed to hold the possibility of more cordial relations. How did Putin use what he knew about Bush to gain a modicum of trust?
This is where being a KGB agent comes in handy. You know how to have a dossier prepared for your adversary. And he had one, a nice thick one on George W. Bush, who had made an announcement after he was elected, surrounded by the wise men of his father's a foreign policy establishment, Colin Powell and Henry Kissinger and George Shultz. He had said, "Mr. Putin," I think he mispronounced his name, "Mr. Putin, I want you to know we're not looking for trouble. We think we can be allies. We think we can be friends." So Bush goes over there, having been told by the wise men of the foreign policy establishment, "You don't have to worry about this shrimp. Just go in there and be friendly with them. The country has the GDP of Portugal. They're not a big problem." So armed with the dossier on Bush, which says Bush is an evangelical Christian, a devout Christian, Putin comes up with a story about a miracle that a dacha had caught on fire, a religious icon, a cross, a wooden cross of his mother's, had somehow survived the fire. And it had come to him, and it stunned Bush in its miraculous nature. And Putin had hit the mark with his fable, I gather, about this miracle. And it causes Bush to say the famous words, "I looked in his eyes, and I've seen the man's soul," which all of Bush's team, Condi Rice and others who we've spoken to, all just blanched. They just went, "Oh, my God, Mr. President, what are you saying?"
Michael, whatever it was Mr. Bush saw in Vladimir Putin's eyes, the former diplomat Daniel Freed notes in the film, Putin was not trained to reveal anything about his soul, certainly not to a U.S. president.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He was, Freed tells us that they all were worried about him. This is the State Department. Bush much less so, and it wouldn't take very long for who Putin really is and what Putin really wanted to be revealed, and they just in the State Department and the people advising George W. Bush kept trying to warn him that he shouldn't take Putin too lightly, but events would transpire that let them know that Putin was done, no more, as they used to say in the commercials, no more Mr. Nice Guy.
Right. How did the Iraq War strain U.S.-Russian relations?
Iraq, as it happens, was led by a despot, a dictator who and happens to be in what Putin considers his, it's not his near abroad, those are, that's Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, but it's in his neighborhood, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. He thinks of that as his world. And to see America knock over the head of a sovereign state, sovereign leader of a sovereign state, like Saddam Hussein, sent chills through Putin, who said, wait a minute. And he had warned Bush not to do this in the aftermath of 9/11, and tried for it not to happen. And it wasn't the only time it would happen that the U.S. would move into what Putin considered his neighborhood and do something that scared the heck out of Putin, which is knock off a despot who looked and acted a lot like Putin.
Is there any indication that the United States had designs on regime change in Russia at that time?
Not that I ever heard about. I mean, we were doing things for sure. You could say we were tweaking the bear, if you want to. I mean, remember, NATO was encircling Russia. There was foment being happening, kind of what looked like independent liberalization occurring in Georgia and these countries in the near abroad. And Putin, the former KGB agent, looks at this and says, I know what this is. This is the CIA of the United States of America under the guise of letting people have democracy, encircling me and locking me in place. I'm not going to put up with it. This is a direct threat, waving a red flag at me, and I'm not going to let the U.S. and the West do this. And this is really the moment where he finally has had it, and gives a speech and threatens the rest of the world. That's the moment, 2007.
This was a time when there was a great deal of upheaval in former Soviet republics. Putin viewed the United States as an instigator. How much truth was there to that suspicion?
Oh, I think there's no question that the U.S. was the fingers of the U.S. intelligence world were all over. They had a lot of practice during the Cold War. Were still active and working, all over the world, and certainly in the territories just in the near abroad of Putin's Russia. Also, the people there were, they were, without Russia as the big big heavy hand in their worlds, they were struggling with their own economies and their own freedoms and their own whatever, and different leaders came in at different times, and they had terrorism issues and all kinds of other things as well. So they were kind of a mess, and America looked like it might be able to be a friendly helping hand in some of those ways. So there were some adventures in that part of the world. The United States would say, no, there weren't. But it doesn't take, you don't have to be an amazing investigative reporter to go look at what happened, listen to people who were there, and realize that there was involvement in our intelligence services, our spy mechanisms, our NSA, the National Security Agency, all of the technology we had was aimed at Russia and China at the time, because it had been, and some of it, some of the USAID money and other things were all being spent, and there was an involvement of American foreign policy people in all these countries as advisors, and American industry was trying to come in and bring what capitalism brought. So there was plenty of cracks in the wall of the way things used to be, and the fingerprints of Americans were all over, and others from the West were all over all of that, as it all looked like one big fat, Kmart to come in and sell our goods and pick up cheap labor and do all kinds of other things from Estonia to everywhere. So yes, America was somehow involved. Were we fomenting revolution in the way Putin thought it was so? Probably, maybe.
Okay, as you've told us, Michael, once the Iraq War was underway, Putin was done trying to forge any kind of cordial relations with the United States. You've told us that President George W. Bush's closest advisors warned him not to underestimate what Putin might be willing to do. Putin, meanwhile, had been warning against any attempts to expand NATO. George W. Bush encouraged both Georgia and Ukraine to apply for membership. How did that play into Putin's attack on Georgia in 2008?
Well, there's this incredible moment where they're doing it. And he has gone to Munich a few months earlier to the national, I mean, they've just had it in Munich. Again, they every year the foreign policy world comes together and they talk about big things that are facing everybody. Putin shows up and delivers a speech that just blows everybody away. They're all sitting in there, all of the major figures, I mean, not the President of the United States, but everybody else, Secretary of Defense, they're all there. And Putin attacks and says, look, I'm not going to put up with it anymore. I've had it with what America and the West is trying to do. Who would put up with this, he says. This is not going to last. This is not going to stand. And when he leaves Munich, after just knocking everybody's socks off with this speech, it is the beginning of, a bomber that they develop in Russia to carry nuclear weapons. It is the beginning of a kind of pushback that he gets started. And when he hears that Bush is encouraging Georgia and others to join NATO, he breaks into the meeting that's being held. Putin arrives, crashes the dinner where Bush is at a table, sits down, begins an argument with Bush about, you guys can't do this. This is my territory. This is my world. You would not like it if I came into, California and did this. And Bush just sits there and shakes his head like, what's up with this guy? Gosh, he just doesn't have any style or a line or anything. He's just coming in looking for a fight all the time. And what happens is, of course, Putin invades Georgia, sends in troops, holds them, and tests Bush's will. What is Bush going to do about it? He's pushed back on Bush with forces. Now the President of the United States, George W. Bush, who's got plenty of other things to worry about, all of the Middle East, for example, which is in flames, Bush kind of says, we can't do anything about this. So Putin sort of holds onto the ground until a moment when they're in Beijing at the Olympics. And lo and behold, we have pictures and video of this at the ceremonies of the Olympics. Bush is in the same row with the King of Cambodia and Putin's down the row a little ways. He makes his wife Laura move and the King of Cambodia move, and Bush slides down and sits next to Putin and says, "Listen, pal, you can't do this. This is not the way the world. You're pushing us right up to the edge of war, and you really got to stop doing this. What do you What's the problem?" And Putin just says, absolutely not. Go away. You're not going to convince me not to do this. This is my part of the world, and I'll do whatever the heck I want to do there. And it's then that Bush realizes, and all the people around him, and Bush says to his national security staff, we've lost him. I don't know what happened. I mean, I don't know why he doesn't know what happened, but we've lost him. We don't have him anymore. Putin's off the reservation.
The first meeting between Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama is described here as a clash of egos. How did that play out?
So Obama comes to Russia. It's the early summer, late spring. Putin greets him at his summer dacha, his very lavish house out in the country. They come in the room. You can see them come in the room. Obama sits down, and the first thing Putin does is what he always does with foreign diplomats, especially presidents. He talks for 45 uninterrupted minutes and what everybody just kind of rolls their eyes always when Putin comes to a room like this, what they call the airing of grievances. And he just goes on for 45 minutes complaining to Obama, whose, you know, eyes have rolled to the top of his head by then. People who, something really fascinating is actually going on there. I've seen the footage, I've reported on it before, but in this film, we had somebody who sat with us and said, listen, you understand that Putin is a racist. And the last thing Putin wanted to do was share the video limelight, share the center stage moment in his house, sitting next to a black man. He just felt it was beneath him. And he couldn't believe that America and Americans would elect a black man to be president of the United States. So there, let's just say their relationship was doomed from the very beginning. Obama, who had a cratering economy, as you'll recall, was trying to get healthcare going in America, had a million irons in the fire. The last thing Barack Obama wanted to do was deal with the little guy from Russia. And you see them leave the meeting, and Obama gives this wave, which is like, you know, you're in the rearview mirror, buddy. I'm out of here. And of course, what does Obama do? He does what presidents do when there's something they don't want to do. He gives it to his vice president and says, you handle this, Joe. And the vice president, of course, turns out to be Joe Biden.
I do want to talk about the sort of outsourcing of that relationship to then Vice President Joe Biden, Michael. But I just want to draw a line under this. Putin's overt racism really flies in the face of this claim that was often used in defense of communism, that, look, the communists saw every single human being as equal. They didn't or wouldn't have had the problems with racism that continue to plague the United States.
Well, I mean, that may be the theory, that may even be the goal, and certainly communism is aspirational, if not a lot of other things, to a lot of people. Individuals, certainly Vladimir Putin's life and history, this feisty little guy ready to mix it up with anybody, and very little access to anybody black, any minorities, would have his prejudices. It's not surprising that he would have them. It's surprising that you could become president and not deal with that constituency, but you run Russia, and your biggest problems are Chechenian rebels and terrorists and others who are your problem. It's not a African American or a black another minority. Groups that you feel I'm president of everybody, like Obama said he was, and I'm here to help everybody. Putin was free to be whatever he wanted to be by then, and if he wanted to be a racist, and apparently he did, this was his opportunity to show it on the world stage.
Okay, so then Vice President Biden, like Vladimir Putin, had, perhaps still has, a worldview thoroughly shaped by the Cold War, which is to say, Biden did not even pretend it was possible to trust the Soviets, which is the term he used, even though by that point it was Russia he was dealing with. What did Biden do to directly antagonize Putin?
He just took him on. He took him on. He went to Russia and sat in a meeting across a table from him, and I'm not here to praise Joe Biden by any stretch of the imagination. It's not my job or intent, but it's fascinating when you watch all the presidents line up. By the time it gets to Biden, after Clinton and after George W. And what happened to Obama at the Dacha, Joe Biden knows and feels deep in his soul, as a former United States Senator on the Foreign Relations Committee, and then the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, he's had plenty of dealings with cold warriors and is himself, even as a Mandarin from Washington, he's ready to go and mix it up with and recognizes when he sees in Putin what he sees in Putin, which is another one of these an equivalent kind of cold warrior that he's going to mix it up with, and he confronts him and calls him out and says, I've looked in your soul. He says it directly to him. Our witness to this is Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, who gave us a wonderful and long interview where he played his Zelig role, because he was standing next to Biden in these days and Obama in those days, and then eventually, as he is now, next to Biden, the president, in what's going on over there. So Blinken tells us that he looks at Biden, looks at Putin, and says, "I've looked in your eyes, and I recognize you don't have a soul, Vladimir." And Putin looks at him and smiles, the way the story goes anyway, and says, "At least we understand each other, Mr. Vice President."
Michael, Joe Biden as vice president wanted the United States to mount a very strong response to Russia's seizure of the Crimean Peninsula. Why did Obama overrule him on that?
Well, there were a number of people. I mean, Russia has taken, Putin has taken Crimea. He's taken parts of eastern Ukraine. This is 2008, 2009. I'm sorry, I don't remember the year right now. Anyway, he's come in and I think it's 12 or 13. I'm sorry. Anyway, he's taken this territory, and many people in the American Defense Department, and many people at the highest levels of the State Department, and many people inside of his administration, including his vice president, come to Obama and say, "You must give these Ukrainian people Javelin missiles that they can fight back with. They're going to get slaughtered here, and we have to." We have John Brennan, the CIA director, say in the film, a former CIA director under Obama, say, "You know, he Putin is a schoolyard bully. He needs to get his nose bloody." And they all said this to President Obama, who takes it under advisement. And no matter how hard Biden pushes, Obama decides, no, he says, I was not elected by the people of the United States of America to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. It's just not what I'm gonna do. The thing about giving missiles to these people is it becomes a slippery slope and away we go. And I'm not here to do that kind of thing. And it just frosts Biden and the people at the State Department, the people at the Defense Department. They cannot believe it. And they keep saying, "He's going to take a message from this, Mr. President, that says he's free to do whatever he wants to do over there. You're going to give it, you're giving it to him. And you can pay me now or pay me later, but you are definitely going to pay later if you don't do something about this now." And Obama decides not to do it.
What was Putin's goal for Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. elections?
Things have happened along the road where, especially recent things in the world of 2014, 15, and 16, when Biden came over and confronted him and told him, "I've looked in your eyes, you are soulless." Biden then went over to the University of Moscow, or Moscow University, and told the students, "Hit the streets, get out there and defend democracy. You have the right to freedom of speech. Get out there and do it." Well, this rocks Putin's world. He can't believe it, because the people do go to the streets, and he doesn't. Putin just is bonkers about it, and Hillary Clinton does the same thing. She gives a podcast, she gives a speech, she is encouraging, seen by Putin at least, to be encouraging the people in his country to protest against him. And a couple of 100,000 people are on the streets in Moscow. This is never heard of before by Putin. So he's angry. So one of the things he wants to do is he wants to destroy Hillary Clinton's chances, if he can, to become president by getting involved in our election, by attacking through social media and other means the campaign for presidency, and create as much chaos and division in the United States as possible, and forming, we'll never really know, but maybe we will someday, and forming a kind of maybe indirect, maybe direct alliance with Donald Trump, who's trying to do the same thing, create chaos, create division to win the presidency. So here's Putin and Putin's revenge, which is to get involved in an effort led by his version of the National Security Agency, to get in and mess around in our, you know, invading our computer networks, and spreading division and chaos in America. And it is all part of a kind of revenge mechanism to help Donald Trump get elected, and especially to help to make sure Hillary Clinton loses. And much to his surprise, it and many other things, including Hillary's own lack of complete stardust that may have gotten her elected, Putin witnesses the surprise of his lifetime, which is that his guy, Donald Trump, wins.
President Trump does not seem to have ever been on his guard with President Putin. He took the Russian leader's flattery at face value. What do we know about how Putin actually felt about Trump and Trump's abilities as a leader?
Well, the people who watched them closely and paid a lot of attention said that John Bolton, for example, Trump's national security advisor, told us that he played Trump for a fool. He just thought Trump was silly. It wasn't even hard. He didn't need a dossier, Bolton said. He knew who Trump was. It was easy to read. And he played him for everything it was worth. And Trump was just, who liked authoritarian figures anyway, Trump was just completely vulnerable. And people say what happened in Helsinki, where Trump says, I don't believe my national security advisors, I don't believe my CIA advisors who say Putin was involved and Russia was involved in messing around in the 2016 election. Putin says, I asked Putin this just today, and he said he didn't do it, and I believe him. Well, there were people in the room, including very highly placed members of of Trump's own administration, who said that their blood just ran cold when he said those words. Never before had they heard a president of the United States say such a thing about someone who was so obviously been involved in it and was so obviously an enemy of the United States. So that's when a lot of people started to worry a great deal about what Putin's real ambitions were and how much he was now feeling really relaxed in the presence of a powerful American president, that he could probably take Ukraine without the United States doing anything about it.
Did Putin's opposition to NATO and its expansion directly shape Trump's views on NATO, or were they just sort of already in alignment?
It's hard to say. Remember the phrase, I love this phrase, I was reminded of it as we were making the film, and we were interviewing someone who said, remember, we called it a bromance between these two guys. And you had Trump parroting word for word things that only Putin had been saying, which was Ukraine isn't a real country. There are a lot of Russians who live there who speak only Russian. There isn't really such a place as Ukraine in the minds of Russia. And Trump would say these things that no president, even Bush, when he was really trying to sally up next to Putin, would say. It was amazing to people to see how the two of them were in such lockstep and how supportive of Putin Trump really was.
So, to John Bolton's point that Putin and his team did not need a dossier on Trump, there are some Americans inclined to dislike President Trump who assumed that Putin's folks dug up some dirt on him and sort of compelled his capitulation to their ideas. It sounds like you didn't find evidence of that Bolton said it wasn't necessary because Trump was ready to fall in line with Putin's thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And so did Steve Hadley, who was the former national security advisor for Bush. I mean, Hadley said, you know, what's not to like about Putin if you're Trump? I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, absolutely supportive of Trump in every way. And here's Trump who's absolutely supportive of Putin because he likes the way he likes the cut of his jib. He likes the way he is. And he's always, he was very, Trump was very, very drawn to authoritarian leaders and especially Putin. And of course, there are many who say he had commercial interests that he wanted to make sure were covered when he eventually ended his presidency. But I don't think you need all of those levels of proof, although those are certainly interesting theories, and maybe one day they will be proven, all you really need to know is what you see right before your eyes, which is how Trump acted whenever he interacted with or spoke about Vladimir Putin, you know, who was by then a sworn enemy of the United States of America and democracy all over the world, and was doing what he could to clamp it down in certainly in Crimea, which he'd illegally taken, certainly in parts of Ukraine, which he was taking, Belarus, what he did in Georgia. I mean, we know who he is, and Putin knew who Trump was, and especially knew who he wasn't, and whatever they cooked up together or imagined together, it didn't seem to me they needed videotapes of the so-called events at the Ritz-Carlton right off Red Square in that hotel room with Trump and prostitutes and other allegations of things that were made. It may or may not have happened. We may or may not ever know what really happened, but it didn't seem like they needed something on this guy. He was wide open to whatever Putin wanted to do from the get-go.
Michael, how has Joe Biden managed U.S.-Russian relations as president? Is he essentially doing for Ukraine what he wanted Obama to have done when the territory in question was the Crimean Peninsula?
I think the answer is at least he's doing at least that, and much more. They knew, this is their story to us. Secretary of State Blinken certainly told it to us, that they started to receive information that Russia was mounting its forces on the border of Ukraine. And despite the fact that Biden would get on the horn with Putin and say to Putin, you know, what are you doing lining all these guys up? We know you're going in. We have intelligence that says you're going in. And Putin would say, no, I'm not. I'm not going to do that. Whatever you're getting, it's false. But they were getting, they had what, according to them, unbelievable intelligence, sky vision, everything, spies, everything, the troop movements, you know, everything, fuel intake, they had it all. And they knew that he was preparing an invasion to go get it. So Biden was, in that sense, free in terms of evidence to know that he was on the sort of right moral course, or whatever it is, legal international law course, that he could go forward. He was, of course, you don't want to get in there and mix it up if you can talk the guy back and threaten him and say, look, we know Vladimir, so don't do it. You know, you don't want to make America and the West mad. He went out and he formed, you know, this 40 nation coalition. He got Sweden and Finland, or whoever it was, Norway, to want to join a NATO too. Got the Western world all lined up. An act of diplomacy that many people thought could never happen in the wake of what Donald Trump had tried to do to destroy our alliances with Western democracies, liberal democracies in the country. So Biden, you know, following every single step on the playbook of what you're supposed to do, short of going to war, started to get involved in a thing that had gone much further along than where it was with Obama and what was happening with the Maidan and other places in Ukraine when Obama was president and they were after the javelins. He was not going to blink an eye. Biden was javelin, sure, whatever else. What do you need?
So look, Putin can appear quite inscrutable because he makes his biggest decisions in the company of this small and insular group of advisors. The Kremlin has always been an incredibly opaque institution. Michael, did reporting for this film tell you anything about how U.S. leaders could better understand what he is thinking and planning and manage his behavior?
We had the best, I guess we have one of the best, maybe the best intelligence agencies in the world. We have alliances with lots of other really good ones, MI6 and others. And then January 6 happens, and somebody told us, That meant that was the green light for Putin to go. When he saw the chaos and division inside America that's sacking our own Capitol building, he said, well, this place is such a mess. They are confirming everything I believe about democracy, which is there really isn't a democracy in America. And this president, weak old Mandarin Joe Biden, what a blowhard, what an old time codger this guy is. I'm going. And Biden will never, ever, ever step up. And he did. And he has. And I think that's a big surprise to Vladimir Putin.
Journalist Michael Kirk is a filmmaker with the PBS documentary series Frontline. His latest production is titled Putin and the Presidents. Michael, it is always such a pleasure to learn from your reporting, even though what we're talking about is often quite serious. I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Chris. You ask great questions. It's good to talk to you.
You too. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.